fun to be here. I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I've ever taught at Holton Village, so, you know, something I've known about and thought about for a long time, so I'm a little nervous about that. I'm also a little nervous because my spouse is here this morning, and I can't remember the last time she came to a session of mine that I've done. I mean, not because she's not interested. I'm sure she is, just that, you know, she's real busy.
Teaching with her role.
Yeah. But then I thought, well, I don't know, if I feel nervous, I go to hear her preach all the time. So, I mean, fair is fair for her to come back, be here this morning. Conversations with Fellow Travelers is the title that I've given to this. It's going to be, I teach historical theology. So I teach the history of theology as it's developed in the church. My primary areas that I work on are the Reformation and then the early modern period, that is the 1800s and on. And I teach in a seminary setting, and so one thing that's clear for me in my work is that the work that we do in studying theology is for the purpose of ministry. It's for the purpose of trying to further our faith, further our witness to what it is that we believe. And I think the key, one of the keys for me, I teach historical theology, so usually I'm teaching about people that are dead, been dead for a long time, and part of the job is for me, with your help, to try to help those people come alive for us during this time and to join in the conversation that we're having so that their voice can be heard, not only the voices of those of us who are here and living today. So it's conversation. I love conversation. Some people will say I love conversation because I love to hear myself talk. I'm working on that. In fact, one of the things that I've learned and one of the things that I would really emphasize for us is that one of the keys to making good conversation happen is listening. The ability to listen and really hear what the other person is saying. That will be one of the keys, and that's a real key, I think, to the study of any history. To be able to listen to some of the ancient texts that we have that are going to come from a world that's very different from the way we conceive of our world, the way we picture our world. So to be able to hear some of those voices and hear how they saw and experienced the world. Because our filters on our ears and on our eyes are pretty thick. And if we don't listen carefully, we won't hear them as they would want to be heard. So listening is one of the keys, I think, to what we're going to do together. Another key is imagination. And it may sound a little odd, and I know a lot of people who think of history as a sort of scientific enterprise think there's no place for imagination here, but I think imagination is crucial. Because we can't get back to the 300s and 400s with Augustine, whom we're going to talk about today. But we can read some of the things he wrote, we can hear him talked about, and then to try to get beyond the step after the listening is to try to imagine ourselves into that world. What might it have felt like to have been this person in North Africa 1,500 years ago? Well, we can't know. But by opening our imaginations and allowing our imaginations to take us there, after we've listened, that order is pretty crucial, you know. If we just use our imagination, then who knows if it'll have any connection to what happened with Augustine. But if we listen first and then try to use our imagination, we have some way of trying to enter that world and see what it's like. So it's a conversation this morning. We're going to listen. We're going to listen to Augustine this morning. During the week, we're going to listen to some other historical and contemporary figures. We're going to do some listening to each other, because one of the rich resources that we have at a place like this is the great variety of people and all that they bring. So we're going to spend some time listening to each other and talking with each other. And then we're also going to spend some time listening to ourselves. If your life is anything like mine, it's plenty busy, and there's very little time to stop and listen to the witness of our own lives. God has been present with us. God is active with us, even when we don't stop to realize it. And so often we don't stop to realize it and don't stop to hear and then claim the grace that's been present in our lives all along. Because, at least for me, I get so caught up in what I've got to do day to day, and I don't find that time to stop, get a little quiet, and listen to my own heart and what God may be telling me through the experience of my own life, through my own heart. So we're going to listen to some ancient and contemporary witnesses. We're going to listen to each other, and we're going to listen to ourselves in the times that we'll share. I want to start us with both listening and imagination. I'm going to borrow a guided imagery, which I think is a good form of involving us with history and with our imagination and with our listening. It's from a marvelous little book from the Alban Institute. It's called Peacemaking Without Division. And it's a book that tries to find ways that congregations can deal with difficult moral issues and really hear each other and talk with each other. And there's a guided meditation in here that I'd like to share with you. In order to do this, you need to relax. Looks like you're in pretty good shape that way, but it's good. You need to, I'm going to ask you to imagine some things as I read for you, so if you need to take a deep breath to relax yourself further, be comfortable in your chair, close your eyes if that helps you, leave them open if that's better, and then let your mind travel to another time and another place. Then, the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the authorities, Jesus came and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be unto you." And when he had so said, he showed them his hands and his side. Then were the disciples glad when they saw the Lord. Then said Jesus to them again, "Peace be unto you. As my Father has sent me, even so send I you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. Whosoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven, and whosoever sins you retain, they are retained." Imagine yourself as one of the disciples in first century Palestine. Imagine a room with a single door, tightly barred. The one whom you have followed for nearly 3 years, the one you have set your hopes on, has suddenly been taken from you and crucified. It is all over. Experience the feelings of shock, grief, confusion, disorientation. He says again, "Peace be with you." As my Father has sent me, so I send you. Receive the Holy Spirit. Feel the power of the Spirit, strengthening, sweeping away the fear, sending you out beyond the locked doors, into the city, into all the world. Remain sitting quietly, if you would, but let your mind come into the present. In your present life, what are the things against which you bar the door? Sense the locked door in your own heart, in your mind, barred by fear. Who is shut out? Now feel the presence of Jesus come into your heart and mind through that locked door. Feel his presence and the joy, the delight of being with him. Let him speak to you. He tells us that the sins we retain are retained. Those we let go of are forgiven. Are there sins, offenses, fears that we need to let go of? And now, let the Spirit of God move through you, if she will, releasing, letting go, encouraging, empowering. Feel the locked door melt away as fear is replaced by love, by the power of God. Sense yourself set free, empowered, sent by the Spirit of God. As you're ready now, you may want to close your meditation with a silent word of thanks. And then, when you're ready, bring yourself back into the presence of our group. Okay, it looks like most everybody's back. And I think the ones that aren't back are asleep, so it's, you know, okay. As you think about that experience now, just having had it, any observations, any thoughts or feelings about that experience you'd like to share with the group?
Only God's power could bring you from one extreme to the other.
That occurred to you as you...
It's a long way to go.
Yeah, it is. It is.
God was merciful to come through that door rather than to fling it open.
That's interesting. Did that strike you at some point along the way, or worry about God flinging the door open?
When you consider what all of my fears might be, or concerns, or what might be outside the door, for God to suddenly expose those things and sort of without his empowerment or his presence first being there, I think would be overpowering. And, as I, in your meditation, kind of contemplated the door was on the other side, it was a shuddering experience. The fact that he had come through the door and had left that door shut, sort of that maternal gentleness almost, caring for those fears. And
right, this wasn't John Wayne busting down the
door,
right,
was
exactly. It was going through it.
Came into where we were.
We don't have to open the door. God will come through that door.
It's interesting.
I experienced the comfort of knowing that everyone has the door. And being in touch with that, I live with my own door. But it is part, slightly comforting to know that there is a door for everything.
Yeah. I'm not the only one that other people struggle with. Fears and doubts. Did it work for you? Did any of you have trouble doing it? I mean, it's not necessarily bad. I'm curious. So maybe I should put some things up on the board for you.
It's always been that way, so.
Uh-huh. Well, and that's an important piece of learning about listening to ourselves and figuring out how it is that we learn, because there are different styles of learning and different ways that speak to us. Some of us, imagination works real well. Others of us need it written down. It's good to be in touch with.
I found it helpful to go through this with my eyes closed, which I didn't know it was much more real.
So did pictures come to you then?
Yes, definitely.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the way that I like to go at my work in historical theology and trying to get us into this conversation with each other and with these figures from the past. I had a student a year ago teaching one of my standard classes, which I call Classics of Christian Theology, and we read some stuff about the creeds, and then we read Augustine, and then we read Julian of Norwich and Luther and different people. And I had this one woman in there, kind of an angry young woman in some ways, and came and told me that she was a Christian and she belonged to a church, but she was also a witch and belonged to a coven in Kansas City where I live and teach. And I was pretty scared about that. I didn't know if I could handle this person in class who was going to really feel alienated from much in the Christian tradition. You know, and then we're reading Augustine, the second person. I thought, oh Lord, what's going to happen here? And her question always was with these guys, because in the beginning we were reading all these male figures, was her question always was, what are these guys so afraid of? You know, because she felt like they were really erecting these walls of what they believed, and it felt to her like she was being kept out. And her question was always, what are these guys afraid of? And it struck me as a real helpful question to try to get at what somebody's about. What is it that they're afraid of? What is it that they're worried about? Because most of us in our own witness and our own lives are trying to find ways to live with our fears and not be paralyzed by them, and find ways to help other people deal with constructively what it is that we're afraid of anyway. So I think that's a real, real helpful question as we try to study some different figures. What is it that they're worried about? What is it that they're afraid of? And of course, also a very good question to ask of ourselves, to get in touch with our where we're at, with our own struggles. What is it that we're afraid of? Help us in the process of knowing ourselves. You all know the bumper sticker that says, Jesus is the answer. It's a fine bumper sticker. I like to say that's important to know. In many ways, what's more important, I think, is to know, what is the question? If Jesus is the answer, that's great, but what is the question that Jesus is the answer to? And I say that to let me say a little bit about the kind of way I go at historical theology, and now I will write something on the board for those that helps, you know.
I
can
hear, but I don't see them.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm going to help written down. I just need to be able to
You're the virtual.
Okay, yeah. So you're, I'm hearing an audio learner over here, one who needs... Well, for the visual learners out there, one of the influences on me as I came to identify myself as a historical theologian, I came to realize that the work of Paul Tillich was real helpful to me, because Tillich says that the way that we need to do theology, and in fact he would say the way we do theology, is what he calls the method of correlation. We have to correlate two different things. We have to bring two different things together. And what are the things that we need to correlate? Well, Tillich says what we really need to correlate, to bring together in our theology, is the human question and to do theology, Tillich says, we need to bring together the human question with the divine answer. Over here, you know, as Christians, we might call the divine answer the gospel. And I find this helpful as a historical theologian, which is what I am. I find this kind of approach helpful because one of the things that Tillich is recognizing as he says this is that the human question varies over time. This approach is trying to take history seriously and recognize that things change, that people are different in different places and at different times, and that the way the question of our lives gets framed is different. And why is that important? Well, it's important to ministry because if we're going to say Jesus is the answer, we need to say it in a way that tries to respond to the question that people are asking. And if we recognize that different people will ask the question in different ways, we recognize too then that our witness needs to be appropriate to the particular situation that we're talking to. Our ministry needs to try to speak to people where they're at. And that was, really appreciate that insight that several of you had about that text from John that we read this morning about Jesus not knocking the door down, about us not needing to open the door, but about Jesus coming through. I think that applies to us as persons of faith, as we try to witness in our diverse ways, that we need to try to meet people where they're at. We need to have some sense of what their question is and of what the, and then of how the gospel can be expressed in a way that will speak. Just to flesh this out a little bit in terms of history, what Tillich says is that if we look at the early church, first several hundred years, especially where the church is part of the Greek-speaking world, which the church was in the earliest years, Tillich says, what is the central question that emerged out of people's lives? What was the human question for these people? And Tillich suggests that in this earliest period, we'll find that the central question for many people, at least for the people we know well, is the question of death. What are these guys so afraid of? My witch friend would ask. Well, we'd say many people in this period are afraid of death. And that being the case, then, one of the important ways that the Christian gospel was framed was as the gift of eternal life. One of the early church fathers, I can't remember now if it's Ignatius or who it is, talks about the Eucharist as the medicine of immortality. Now think about that. I mean, what's the question behind that? Well, pretty clearly, question of death there, with the Eucharist then providing us with a way to move beyond. Tillich, being a good Protestant, after talking about the Greeks, jumps all the way to the Reformation. He says, you know, what's the human question in the period of the Reformation? And actually, we could talk in many ways about our friend Augustine, whom we're going to get to shortly, in the same way. The question there is not so much death, although Luther, for example, was concerned about death. And just before his conversion experience, one of his best friends had died, and he had that. He had a near-death experience with that thunderstorm where he was so afraid. So it's not to say that this is pure and you're just worried about death and not about anything else. But Tillich would say the key issue in the Reformation was not so much death as it was guilt. Haven't we inherited plenty of that from our Protestant forebears? But the issue is not so much death but guilt. And that being the case, then, the way we talk about the gospel needs to be somewhat different. It needs to be appropriate to that question. And so the focus clearly for someone like Luther was on forgiveness. The gospel is primarily forgiveness for Luther. Why is that? It's because of the sense of guilt and worthlessness, of not being righteous in the sight of God. And therefore forgiveness provides an answer to that. And there's a nice match between the question and the answer. Tillich said, one thing is clear is that it's easier to go back to a previous historical period and analyze that period and see what the issues were. He says, it's harder in our own day, because we're too close in some ways to really see as clearly how we might name the human question for our own day. But Tillich's brave and wants to suggest modern period, if you want to call it that. Tillich said, what's the issue today? What is it that people are struggling with? And you see, he says, if you want to find out what the human question is, Tillich says, we Christians have no privilege when it comes to figuring out what the human question is. But that is something that just emerges from people's lives. So if we want to figure out what the human question is for us, we don't just look at our lives or just within the church, but we look at the culture as a whole to see what's going on out there. What is it that's driving people? What are people really wrestling with and concerned about? And Tillich, in his own time, and I think he wrote this in the 50s or early 60s, talked about, or suggested, and he was pretty tentative about this, but said, you know, maybe the modern issue is the question of meaninglessness. Does life have any meaning? That was the question that really drove people, and then he suggested, if that's the question, then what he wanted to talk about as the answer, one way to talk about it for him was what he called the courage to be. That we need to face that meaninglessness and be able to claim our own acceptance by God and claim the power and courage that that can give us to go on living and find meaning in that way, find an answer to the threat of meaninglessness. Just to suggest one more option that we might talk about, if we look at more recent than Tillich, liberation type folks, one of the ways to get into them in terms of their question would be to say, what's the question that they're really concerned about? A lot of liberation theologians certainly want to identify oppression as the central human question. It's the one that they are concerned about in their particular contexts. And then, if that's the question, they would want to suggest in different ways, obviously there's a lot of variety within liberation theologies, suggest that in one way or another, liberation is the answer. Christ is the liberator in one way or another, in whom we can really be free, but which is obviously a theme of someone like, I mean, Luther will talk about freedom too here in the Reformation, but when Luther talks about freedom, he's going to mean something rather different from what a contemporary liberationist is going to mean by freedom. And that's where, again, to me, it's real helpful to try to get back and say, what is the issue that they're struggling with? Because if we get clear about what that is, then we know what they mean by either Luther or liberationist, talking about liberation and freedom. And they're going to mean some things that are rather different from each other. So this is to give you some sense of the way that I try to go at my own work in historical theology, of trying to listen to different people in different times and different places. And the question that helps me the most in trying to understand somebody else is this question of, what is it, the question that my witch friend asked, what are these guys so afraid of? What's the question behind it? And then, what sense can we make out of the way that they see an answer to that? Any comments or questions you've got about that little piece?
I was waiting for you to write down the word self when you were listing human questions. Mm. Seems to me that's a very modern thought in many, many minds. Mm-hmm.
Trying to find a self or be a self. That sort of thing.
I wasn't going to offer anything on the right hand side.
Okay.
I was thinking the question might be more like isolation, but that maybe go along with self too. Mm-hmm.
The fact that we're so individualistic, say, in North American society, and lack of community, that would be a good example of another form of the question. The thing about self, I was teaching in an elder hostel this spring, and I had one of those people in the elder hostel was a retired Christian Reformed pastor, and he said, you know, you teach a lot differently than the way I was taught when I was in seminary. And now, one of the things he said was, you're just so psychological. You're doing all this psychology. And that was really, in a way, that was real helpful to me to recognize that my own approach is not sort of laying out doctrines or dogmas particularly, but I do have a lot of interest in sort of psychological questions that are going on behind the theology. But that was real helpful to hear somebody name it in that way. Is real different from what I did in seminary 4 years ago.
Can you use the word justice on the other side of oppression? Huh? That maybe we would look at it that way too. The question is oppression and the answer is justice.
Justice, yeah, certainly. That'd be real important. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the goal of liberation is
that's right.
To move towards.
Mm-hmm. Our witch, Christian witch.
Yeah, our Christian witch.
Where do you suppose she came up with this question about their fears? Was she implying that the combination found her with fewer fears?
I don't know.
Or was she just trying to be a devil's advocate?
I think
But I mean, some people do that.
Yeah, I think that's legitimate. Legitimate question. I think she was just, at first, really put off by these folks, these early male Christian types. I gotta say, she really, I won't take credit for this, but she really, she came to like Augustine in the end, and I was just blown away. I just never expected that to happen. So. Well, he's our main conversation partner today, so let's move on and let me say a little bit about Augustine and what he's all about. I mean, he's so big that he deserves not just a session, you know, he deserves a lot of time, but so do these other people, so we're not going to spend. Western theology has been called, or Western, let me back up, Western philosophy has been called a series of footnotes on Plato, which isn't bad. Western theology has been called a series of footnotes on Augustine. And you can say Augustine or Augustine, either way is fine. I was asked that earlier. We all stand in the shadow of this figure from the 4th and 5th centuries. Whether we know it or not, and if we had time to study him in detail as we went along, all of us would find in different ways, oh yeah, that's the way I look at things, and we'd find it many ways it traces back to this character from the 4th and 5th centuries. Some of it good and some of it ill. I don't want to make Augustine into a total hero because there are some ways in which he's influenced the Western world in very negative ways, particularly around issues of sexuality. Augustine had great hang-ups about his sexuality. And that's marked us all. He's one that imported a lot of our shame and guilt around sexuality. But he also did some, I think, tremendously positive things, and is just a marvelous character to wrestle with. One of the things about Augustine you see, we are in the West. We are, we Protestants are descendants from the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, which is the Western Church, that is the Latin-speaking Church. Prior to that, and continuing on to this day as its own separate tradition, of course, we have the Greek-speaking Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, which then also spread up north through the Slavic lands and eventually to Russia. But the distinction between the Greek Church and the Latin Western Church is a crucial one, and Augustine is the one who shapes us in the West. The folks in the East didn't like him very well. He's a saint in the Catholic Church. In the Eastern Church, he's just blessed, you know, which is that's a rank below saint. So, and it's a very different feel in the East. And part of that has to do with this Monica's son. One of the other things about Augustine is that Augustine was an African. He was born in North Africa, was of African descent. And most people don't know that or think about that. And of course, it's a great irony in a way. We think of Augustine as the Western, European, Latin figure, and he was, but he was also African and came from North Africa, spent time in Italy, both in Rome and Milan, and then eventually went back to North Africa where he was bishop in Hippo. And so it's between Algeria and Libya today is where he would have been. But that was part of the Roman Empire at that time, and Augustine was Latin-speaking and shapes the West, but he was also African. And, that's important to remember. One of the things that we got from Augustine, which again is one of those things that's...
The purple rags, maybe?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. So how has Augustine shaped us all in the West? One of the titles that's sometimes given to him is that Augustine is the founder of what we call the introspective conscience. West. In a way, of course, that goes back to Plato too, and Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. But Augustine, in a way, intensifies that. What do I mean here? I mean that Augustine is always looking within to his own soul, to use his language, and looking especially at the question of his motives. You know, if you talk about Augustine was not, that is to say, Augustine was not a behaviorist, right? He's not worried about what people do or what he does. What he's worried about is, why do people do what they do? And why do I do what I do? And so he's always looking within and asking about his own motives. And very concerned about that. And so this is part of that. My own interest in psychology dovetails with Augustine because there's a real psychological feel to Augustine. He's asking about how the human mind and human spirit work and what are the forces that are within us that are driving us and how can we change and transform those forces. As you may know, Augustine argues with a lot of people. One of the people he argues with is Pelagius. Pelagius was not so concerned with motives. Pelagius was more concerned with behavior and doing the right things. And Pelagius was a great Christian missionary who did a lot to spread Christianity, especially in Britain. And we overlook that when we think of Pelagius and identify him as a heretic. I mean, he was finally condemned as a heretic, but he was also a very effective Christian missionary. Pelagius was sort of a positive thinker type, you know, sort of the Norman Vincent Peale of his day. I don't really think that was all bad, because there was kind of a word of encouragement in Pelagius, you can do it, sort of thing. And Pelagius was more optimistic about the human condition than Augustine. Augustine is very pessimistic and dwells on our sin. That's how he gets tied up in all that. But Pelagius is this missionary who's going around evangelizing people. I mean, one of his effective ways to evangelize people was to, on the one hand, he was a positive thinker. On the other hand, he would preach hellfire and damnation, you know, to try to scare the hell out of people and scare them into the Christian faith. Well, Augustine didn't like that. Augustine didn't like that hellfire and brimstone preaching. And why? Because Augustine said, if you emphasize hell, if you emphasize brimstone and condemnation, what you do is you get people to be afraid of the punishment, but not to be afraid of evil just because it's evil. So again, you see, Augustine wants people not just to do the right things, but he wants them to do the right things for the right reasons. And so again, he's concerned about our sort of inward disposition, our inward orientation, and how and why we're doing what we're doing. I'm concerned with motives and not liking Pelagius and his emphasis on hellfire and brimstone. And I think, I mean, I would say, on the one hand, this introspective conscience of the West, I mean, it's a great gift because there's a kind of psychological depth here in Augustine, who is able to look within and understand how the human soul, how the human spirit operates. And so I think, in one sense, that's a great blessing. That to be able to do that, to ask that question, it's an important question for us in our faith journeys. And I imagine it's a piece of why most of us are here. To be able to look within and talk with other people and figure out who we are and where we're going and where God is calling us to. That fits nicely with what Augustine's about. I do think, on the other hand, it can also be a curse. We've got a good friend who will talk about, I don't know if you ever do this, but our friend admits to doing this, going to a party, and then she gets home and she thinks about, what did I say to so-and-so? And should I have said that, or should I have said something else, and sort of analyzes the whole party in detail, you know, and her own behavior at the party. And if you get obsessive about that of course will make you crazy. And there's some craziness in Augustine where this introspection gets out of control and it's just sort of asking about everything and you can't stop and enjoy life.
But this friend did do her doctoral thesis on Augustine.
Well, that has been. So she comes by it honestly.
That's true.
She did. I've got another friend who talks about the ability to be deliberate and to do deliberation. And Augustine's great at deliberation. Thinking about things and trying to figure out what's going on. But deliberation can become de-liberation, right? Or you've lost your liberation, you've lost your freedom to act because you get caught up in analyzing and thinking. And certainly Augustine was prone to that at times, where he got stuck with things. But in a way, the main thing that I want to bring from Augustine today is this sense of introspection, of looking within and asking, how is it? How is it with my soul? And Augustine is, as I said before, very pessimistic. He has a tremendous sense of our sinfulness. One of the things he argues with Pelagius about is about original sin. And Augustine is a firm believer in original sin. I can be too on those days when my kids are making me crazy, you know. I think, what is it? It's original sin. But profound sense of that, of human sinfulness. And that's where, again, Augustine can get so caught up in guilt that it can be paralyzing. But Augustine is also the champion of grace. That God's grace comes to us as a free gift and it changes us. You see, what for Augustine, what grace does, to use his language, is grace reorients our soul. It changes us within so that we're new in our soul, in our psyche. We become new people. We become people who are able to, by grace, focus on God. You know, the theme that we heard last night and again this morning, begin with God. Begin with God. Well, Augustine would say, we can begin with God because God has already begun with us. God's grace has already been given to us and enabled us to move towards God. And that's what Augustine would want to affirm in terms of what the gospel's about for him. It's about God's grace coming to us, for him, through the church primarily, and changing us within so that we can find our joy, our liberation, our satisfaction in God. And so there's a strong sense of grace in Augustine. What I'd like to do to close this morning is get back to a couple moments for you to meditate and think. And we're going to keep in mind those two, the issue of your question, or we might say your fears, and the answers, or we'll talk about courage as the opposite of fear. And what I'm going to do is ask you to imagine again. I'm going to ask you to imagine yourself at several different ages. Some ages that you were long ago, some ages that some of you aren't yet, so that will really require some imagination to think what you'll be like somewhere down the road. And I'll ask you to imagine a couple different things about each age, but I'll come back to both questions, fears, and what answers did you find, or will you find? Where will you gain? From where will you gain courage? So if you put yourself in an attitude of meditation again, reflection, whatever works for you to relax, to close your eyes or open your eyes.